Well, hello, it's Geraldine Duke here. May I just quickly interrupt before you listen to this podcast? I'd love you to also sample the RN show I present, Saturday Extra. It's like a radio version of your favourite weekend broadsheet. So you can find us, Saturday Extra, via the RN website.
Hello, welcome to the Law Report. Today, two freedom of speech decisions from the High Court. One involving offensive letters to the families of dead Australian soldiers leaves us on a knife's edge. The other leaves us with some blessed silence.
What is coming for you is the condemnation of why you are a sinner.
The High Court has upheld a council by-law that bans preaching in Adelaide's Rundle Mall without a permit.
It's coming for you! It's coming for you!
Today, the court found the by-law burdened political communication, but didn't infringe on the implied constitutional freedom.
And homosexuality and lesbianism is a sin.
They're the sounds of Adelaide's Rundle Street Mall, which up until a decision of the High Court last week, was home to noisy street preachers, the Cornloop brothers, Samuel and Caleb. There's no constitutional right to free speech in Australia, but over the years our courts have developed what's referred to as an implied right to political communication. It was this concept that was at the heart of the High Court case involving the Cornloop brothers. Sean Fuster is the Chief Court Reporter for the Adelaide Advertiser and adelaidenow.com.au.
Samuel and Caleb Cornloop are a pair of brothers who in September 2010 came to very high prominence in South Australia when they started preaching what they considered to be the Word of God in the middle of Rundle Mall, which is, of course, Adelaide's major shopping district. The brothers and a group of their followers were quite happy to use megaphones, signs and placards to walk up and down the mall, preaching very loudly their views on religion, sexuality, gender rights and equality.
So tell me, what were the kinds of things that they would shout in the street with their amplifiers and megaphones?
The Cornaloos and their followers were very quickly branded by Rundle Mall traders and shoppers as xenophobic, racist and sexist because their message was very anti-Muslim, anti-foreigner, anti-woman and anti-gay. They were quite fond of shouting at passers-by that they would be going to hell for whatever they were doing at the moment, be it holding hands or wearing Muslim dress. They talked about foreigners being dirty. They talked about unmarried couples being sinners. And it was the very fire and brimstone, old-school, God-fearing type preaching. Very abusive and very frightening for a lot of people that were in the mall.
So what was the response from shopkeepers and the general public?
Shopkeepers and the general public moved quickly to ask Adelaide City Council to evict the preachers from Rundle Mall. The preachers refused to go. There were several clashes of a non-violent nature with police. South Australian police officers tried to move in on these Friday night prayer meetings and break them up. The preachers would often refuse to go. Eventually, the Adelaide City Council tried to use bylaws that have been in existence since 2004 that say that a person cannot preach, harangue, or otherwise tend ministry within the Adelaide City Council district without first obtaining a permit. The preachers decided that they weren't going to allow that to stand, and the entire matter ended up in the South Australian District Court.
The judge of the South Australian District Court found that the council had, I think, exceeded its powers under the Local Government Act. Is that right?
That's correct. The judge of the district court, Judge Simon Stretton, said that the council had no right to make a bylaw that governed the use of roads in South Australia without getting an act of parliament to support them. Now, the South Australian government didn't support that view of the law. They said that that made a nonsense of a council's powers. And so they appealed the matter to the full court of the South Australian Supreme Court. And that's when things became far more complicated for everyone involved.
And that's because the South Australian Supreme Court upheld the ruling of the District Court and I think went on to say, actually, you can't censor political or religious speech. That's unconstitutional.
That's right. And so Chief Justice Karakas and the full court ruled that it was unconstitutional to require the preachers to have a permit before they started speaking out in the Rundle Mall.
So it went on appeal to the High Court and everybody at that stage got involved. I think you had the South Australian government, you had lots and lots of state governments involved, you had the Commonwealth, you had the City of Adelaide. Why were they all in for a penny, in for a pound?
This is the sort of High Court decision that would have had widespread ramifications for every local government in Australia. It wasn't just about whether someone can preach on a street corner. It was about whether a local government has the right to control their streets, their suburbs, their thoroughfares without first seeking an act of parliament. If the High Court had ruled in a different way, you would have the situation where, for example, a group of traders couldn't have a street party or a open day without first getting Parliament to rule on their ability to do so. That would just completely clog up the works of local councils and effectively make their job incredibly, incredibly difficult.
Now, I understand that the Cornloops were actually self-represented in this case. Is that right?
They were. Caleb Cornlew was the one who did the majority of the speaking. He was fond of saying that he had only a Year 9 education and yet he was beating QCs at their own game, which he viewed as God taking mercy upon Adelaide by allowing the preachers to continue to spread his word.
And he had a good run, but it came to an end last week when the High Court ruled against him, didn't it?
That's right. It said that requiring someone to have a permit to do anything on a thoroughfare is of course impinging upon their freedom of speech, but it doesn't completely remove that freedom of speech. It's a burden, but not an insurmountable burden. Therefore, the constitutional point was put to rest. There is no constitutional issue in requiring someone to have a permit to do things on a thoroughfare. But they then came down on the district court judgment and said that local governments have the right to govern themselves for the sake of the convenience, safety and comfort of their ratepayers. And that includes making rules about roads without going to Parliament for an act first.
Sean Fuster, Chief Court Reporter for the Adelaide Advertiser and adelaidenow.com.au. Essentially, the majority of the High Court ruled that even though the council bylaw restricted free speech, the council was exercising its powers properly in creating that bylaw for public order. Professor Adrienne Stone is the Director of the Centre for Comparative Constitutional Law at the University of Melbourne.
Well, in the words of the justices, what it sought to do was to protect the use of the streets. So it was to, the purpose of this law was to prevent obstruction in the use of the Adelaide Moor or to protect the safe and convenient use of the streets, in this case the Adelaide Moor. And the judges took the view that that's a reasonable and legitimate reason to limit freedom of political communication.
In a number of the judgments, they make reference to the fact that there is a speaker's corner, I think somewhere in the mall, and they weren't restricted from preaching from that, that platform. They just couldn't do it everywhere else. Yes. The fact that there was that alternative, they weren't being stopped completely, they were just being confined.
So I think there are two very important limitations to notice about this law. One is there was an area of the Adelaide Mall known as Speaker's Corner, and the requirement to get permission didn't apply to that area. So it seems that the street church would be able to avail themselves of that area. And the second is that the court has now made it clear that when a decision is made whether or not to give permission to engage in activity in an area like the Adelaide Mall, that the decision maker needs to take into account the question of whether the activity will obstruct the streets or interfere with the safe and convenient use of the streets, and only that question. So going forward, it seems that the High Court has made it clear that this is a limitation on freedom of political communication, but it's a relatively limited one, directed towards a very specific objective, and that's preventing obstruction in the use of the streets.
You are all sinners! You're condemned by God!
Last week, the High Court ruled on another important freedom of speech case, which also involved a potent mix of religion and politics. But unlike the Adelaide case, the result is somewhat inconclusive because we don't know how the court will decide similar cases in the future.
The High Court has split evenly on a major freedom of political speech case involving a man who sent offensive letters to the families of soldiers killed in Afghanistan.
Radical Muslim cleric Sheikh Manharon Monis wrote to the families of British and Australian soldiers who died in Afghanistan. Here he is back in 2010, reading a letter addressed to the family of a dead British soldier.
I write to you to offer my condolences for the loss of a member of your family. I am so sorry that you have gone through a very hard time, and I ask God to give you patience for that sad incident. I advise first myself, then you, to believe in God deeply, and by praying to God, try to stay calm and strong during the difficult times.
It's alleged that in his letters to grieving Australian families, these words of comfort were followed by inflammatory, offensive statements about the dead soldiers. Professor Adrian Stone says these letters led to criminal charges, and Sheikh Monis then argued that these charges are unconstitutional because they impinge on his implied right of political communication.
Sheikh Monis was indicted under a provision of the Commonwealth Criminal Code which creates an offence for the use of the postal service in a way that is offensive, harassing or menacing. And what it is said Mr. Monis did was to send letters to relatives of Australian soldiers who had died in the conflict in Afghanistan, and that those letters in very forthright and even extravagant terms criticised the war in Afghanistan and directed specific insults at the dead soldiers, including things like calling them murderers and comparing them to Hitler. And as a result of that, he was faced with prosecution under this provision of the Criminal Code.
Yeah, he uses some pretty horrible language. I think he sends letters which have, according to Justice Hayden, start with condolences for the loss of your son, and then and say things like, may God grant you patience and guide us all on the right path. But then they go on to call the son a murderer of civilians, and even says, it compares the son to a pig and to a dirty animal, and it calls the son's body contaminated and refers to it as the dirty body of a pig. And as you say, it describes Hitler as not inferior to the son in moral merit. So some pretty strong stuff, and you wouldn't want to receive that in your mail if you were grieving for a lost son.
It's interesting. The court was very clear that this provision, partly because it's a criminal provision, should be interpreted only to apply to the most highly offensive material. It's not enough that it just be the sort of thing that creates hurt feelings. It has to create significant anger, resentment and other forms of emotional reaction. And although, as we will talk about, no doubt, the judges were divided on the outcome here, all of them agreed that these statements were met that very high level of offence.
So he was charged with these criminal offences, and it went all the way to the High Court, and it seems that the big question there was whether this was protected political speech.
That's right. So the Constitution provides protection for what we in constitutional law describe as political communication. So it protects the forms of political communication that we need to have protected in order to ensure that our system of government functions properly as a representative system of government, so that we can make appropriate electoral choices and that we can talk about the public conduct of officials and government policy properly. And again, although there was a division in the court on critical issues, it was accepted by all the judges in this case that this amounted to political communication within that concept because of the criticism of the war in Afghanistan.
But then the court split 3-3. Chief Justice French, Justices Hayden and Hayne all found that you couldn't criminalise this kind of letter writing. What was their logic?
Okay, so the background is to say there is this protection for political communication, but it's been recognised since the outset that it's not absolute. It's subject to certain limits, and that's where you get the point of disagreement. So the three judges you mentioned, the Chief Justices and Justices Hayne and Hayden, took the view this wasn't a reasonable limitation. And I think the terms in which they do so are quite interesting, because what they appear to be saying, these judges, is that a law that seeks to limit political communication in broad terms, but on the basis only that it causes offence, even very high-level offence, can never be valid. So that offensiveness, prevention of offence, is not a legitimate end to which the Parliament can direct laws.
Justice Hayne says, quote, "History, not only recent history, teaches us that abuse and invective are an inevitable part of political discourse." I mean, he's basically saying that this is just part and parcel of democracy.
This gets to the heart, I think, of the reasoning of those judges who would find this law invalid. They want to say that political communication in Australia just is robust and vigorous to the point that it may be offensive, even very offensive. But that just is our tradition. And the Constitution, by creating a system of representative government, requires that political communication be protected, even when it is offensive. Offensiveness can never be a good enough reason to regulate freedom of political communication.
So three judges say offensiveness never a good enough reason. The other three judges, Crennan, Kiefel and Bell, say yes, it is.
Sometimes, if the law is carefully drafted, and they took the view that this law was, and for two reasons. One is that, as we mentioned earlier, the threshold for offence is very high. It doesn't apply just to the merely offensive, only to the very offensive. And secondly, it was important to those three judges that this was a law that applied to not statements made in public, but to statements that were made in a letter that was then delivered to the house of the victim or to the home of the victim, and that represents an intrusion. So in the view of Justices Crennan, Kiefel and Bell, it is legitimate for the Parliament to pass a law that seeks to prevent us from receiving extremely insulting material through the mail into our homes.
Adrienne Stone, the big picture, looking at these two cases together, what do you reckon? Are they consistent?
Potentially. So the first thing to say is that Monis is inconclusive because three judges would have upheld the law and three judges would have ruled it invalid. And so we simply don't quite know the result of that case. But what I think is clear is that the sort of interest that was represented by the law in the Adelaide case, obstruction of traffic, safe and convenient use of the roads, is the sort of interest that the courts are much more sympathetic to. It's fairly uncontroversial in the High Court that a law that pursues those ends can limit freedom of political communication, as long as it limits them in a reasonably proportionate kind of a way. What is much less clear is a law whose very object is to prevent offence, even very severe offence. On that question, in the Monis case, you see that the High Court was divided right down the middle. And I think we won't really get a clear view on that until it's revisited.
Adrienne Stone, how have these issues been addressed or resolved by courts in the USA and in Europe? Let's start with the USA.
Well, the USA is actually a good jurisdiction to talk about because there was a very high-profile case in 2011 which is really uncannily similar in its facts to Monis. And that involved a very radical Christian group that sought to protest at the funerals of dead soldiers.
The wrath of God is on this land and he was.
The Supreme Court voted 8-1 Wednesday in favor of the Westboro Baptist Church. The decision upheld an appeals court ruling that threw out a $5 million judgment to the father of a dead Marine who sued church members after they picketed his son's funeral.
And they would say very offensive things like, thank God for dead soldiers. And it was part of a protest that was really aimed at the tolerance of homosexuality in the United States and particularly in the military.
I think I think what they were trying to say was that the USA's tolerance of homosexuals had meant that God was killing or allowing their soldiers to die in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think it was something along those lines.
Yeah, insofar as we can call that logic, I think that describes it very well, Damien.
The case was called Snyder and Phelps, and I think the father of one of the dead soldiers whose funeral was interrupted by these people, he went to court to try and stop them.
Yeah, Mr. Snyder brought actually a tortious action, a claim that he had suffered emotional distress and that the Phelps family, who were behind the Westboro Uniting Church, had intentionally inflicted emotional distress upon him. So the question was whether the First Amendment, the protection of freedom of speech by the Constitution of the United States, would provide a defence to that tortious action. And the United States Supreme Court, 8-1, said yes, it does. Now, it was, I think, a very standard kind of First Amendment analysis. In First Amendment law, speech on a public issue in a public place is almost invariably protected, and First Amendment law shows a very high degree of tolerance for even the most offensive kinds of speech. So Snyder was significant to the extent it was significant, really because the United States Supreme Court held to its well-established law in the face of a particularly compelling set of facts. And although the United States Supreme Court was absolutely clear it thought that this was terrible and worthless expression, it nonetheless protected it as freedom of speech on a public matter in a public place.
So can we assume that if either Monis or the Adelaide case had come before a US court, they would have found in favour of freedom of speech?
I think that is very likely. But it has to be said, in comparative terms, the First Amendment is highly exceptional. I think no other system of freedom of expression throws quite so much tolerance for highly offensive forms of expression. And in particular, in Europe, there is a much more extensive law against insult and a much more extensive law of defamation that protect against offensive conduct. And so I think that there are two traditions with respect to offence and freedom of expression, one which is best represented by the United States, which takes the view that offensive speech must be protected because freedom of speech means nothing if it's not freedom for the speech that we hate the most. On the other hand, there is a tradition that takes the view, and this is well represented by the United Kingdom and other European jurisdictions, it takes the view that certain kinds of very extreme offence are legitimate objects of regulation, that the state can protect people from them. We care about freedom of expression, but we don't care about it so much that we would protect worthless, highly offensive expression. There are other interests, like our personal dignity or perhaps our equality, which are at issue. What is really interesting to me about Monis is that both sets of ideas are represented, they attract equal support, and they leave us hanging in the balance.
On a knife's edge.
On a knife's edge.
We don't know what the seventh member of the court would have said if they had been appointed at the time.
That's right. And I think it's worth noting that were this to come before the High Court again, and I think it's quite likely that this kind of issue will, that we would see it would be heard by a court that now has two new judges on it, Justice Gageler, who was appointed last year, and Keane. The new Justice Keane, who will be appointed this week. And so in particular, in view of the changing personnel, I think that we just have to regard this as an unsettled area of law at the moment.
Professor Adrienne Stone, Director of the Centre for Comparative Constitutional Law at the University of Melbourne. In fact, the changing of the guard is taking place today. Earlier this afternoon, Patrick Keane was sworn in at a ceremony at the High Court in Canberra. You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and ABC News Radio. Damien Carrick with you. Now a milestone. The Public Interest Advocacy Centre, known as PIAC, is turning 30. It's a non-profit organisation that runs test cases in the public interest, and many of the cases discussed on this program have been brought by PIAC. Last week we discussed two of them, disabled schoolgirl Scarlett Finney's groundbreaking action, brought back in 2000, against a private school that wouldn't let her attend, and the very recent action by Disability Discrimination Commissioner Graeme Innes. He successfully took action against New South Wales Rail Corp over its failure to provide audio announcements telling vision-impaired travellers like himself which station was coming up next. Edward Santow is the CEO of PIAC. He says PIAC has a proud tradition of supporting anti-discrimination cases. One of the most important was a groundbreaking gender discrimination case back in the 90s.
I think the Australian Iron and Steel case was a particularly important case. This case was run in the early days of the Sex Discrimination Act. Our clients were a group of women who worked in the iron and steel industry in New South Wales, and they had fought very hard to be included as employees for Australian Iron and Steel, and we helped them in that process. And then there was a downturn in the economy, and the company decided to apply a policy called last in, first off, which meant that these women were disproportionately affected. So the vast majority of people who were retrenched were these women who'd ironically just, you know, had their win to be employed. So we argued very strongly that this constituted indirect discrimination because the practical impact on women was much, much worse than it was on men. And that argument was ultimately successful. So I think this was a very important case that established how the Sex Discrimination Act would work. But it also established that we shouldn't just look to the superficialities of how a policy might look on paper, but we also need to look at the practical impact. And so that's a case from our earlier period that we're incredibly proud of.
There have been prominent cases where you successfully pushed the envelope, but no doubt there have been lots of other cases that you've taken on which have failed in the courts and really not led to law reform or policy change. Can you tell me about some of those failures?
Yeah, I mean, obviously every case we run, we want to win. But I guess, especially in public interest litigation, by necessity, you are pushing the envelope a bit and sometimes you will lose. We had a case just last year that we brought for our client, Joanne Darcy. Joanne was a really interesting situation. She had an intellectual disability and had committed a number of very minor offences. The sentencing judge in that case decided that she should go to a facility in New South Wales for psychological assessment, and that's what she ended up doing. When she went to that facility, she was held there for over 5 years, which was completely against her will, and it was against the wishes of her family, and even the public guardian made very clear that it didn't support her being detained in this way. Now, we brought a case there for unlawful detention, and ultimately it wasn't successful for a variety of legal reasons that we would describe as fairly technical legal reasons. But what we think this case really shines a light on is the way in which we treat people with intellectual disability in our country. And I think what we all need to really be very clear on is that to the extent that there are restrictions placed on people with intellectual disability, they should be the absolute minimum restrictions. And we think it's completely inappropriate for someone to be sent for psychological assessment to a particular place and to be held there not just for a few days or a week or even a month, but for several years. That, we just think, highlights a real problem with the law.
And when was that woman's detainment? Was that a long, long time ago or just recently?
No, it was just recently. And in fact, the High Court decision in that case to refuse to grant special leave was only last year. So this is something that's happening right now. And we're very concerned that when we do lose a case, that the issue at the heart of the case is still brought to the relevant decision makers. In this case, it's the New South Wales and federal governments that need to perhaps consider a bit more carefully how best to treat people with an intellectual disability.
Edward Santo, looking to the future, where do you see the focus of PIAC being for the next 5, 10, even 30 years?
Well, we're pleased at the progress we've made in areas such as disability discrimination, but we also realise that there's a lot of work still to do in those focus areas. So we've got a case that's still pending in the federal court about access to buses for people with a disability. And there's more work to be done in relation to accessible premises as well. And so we're really interested in continuing to make sure that people with disability are able to participate in community life. But we're also acutely aware that in areas like homelessness, we've made some progress, but just tonight there'll be an estimated 100,000 people in Australia who won't have a home. And so we also realise that there's a lot that still needs to be done to, I guess, address the kind of complex needs of people who are homeless, to make sure that they're given a leg up and are able to address their housing problem, but also the other problems that they may have.
Edward Santo, thank you so much for speaking to the Law Report.
Thank you, Damien.
Edward Santo, CEO of the Public Interest Advocacy Centre, which is turning 30. That's the program for this week. Do visit the Law Report online at abc.net.au/radionational/lawreport. Also, you can get in contact with the Law Report on Twitter. Our handle is @LawReportRN. Thanks to producer James Patterson and to audio engineer this week, Gary Havrillay.